Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack. Now here's the host of the show, a man who once wrote a movie for actor Robert Conrad, but was not allowed to be in a restaurant with him. It's TV's Tim Stack. Yay, Tim Stack. Yay, he's good. Oh, yeah, we like him. Hey, welcome everybody to another, I believe this is the episode one of season two of It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack. So I got a pickup. I just got told before we were recording I was picked up for the second season. So that's a big day. I should get drunk right now, and but I'm not going to. Instead, we have a great guest, which I'll get to in a second. I will tell the Robert Conrad story. I sort of miswrote that because I was actually allowed to be in a restaurant with him. Let me go back. I wrote a movie with a friend named Larry Williams. This would be 1985, called Glory Days, which you can find on Crackle, which is basic cable streaming crack. It's like, it's where shows you've never heard of go to live in purgatory, is Crackle. Well, I don't know, Jeff, you maybe have a show on Crackle. We can talk about that.
Took me so long to get a show findable when I was but so Crackle is it's good. It's not exactly the senior league. I think it's nice. I think people have heard of Crackle.
Okay, yeah, you're exactly right. Or they've right. seen it on their screen, but they've never gone there. Jeremiah's saying no, he's never heard of Crackle.
Like a bad neighborhood, you know about it.
Yeah. So, but you don't go there. So
clear history after you've gone to Crackle.
You're afraid to go there. I'm not going to Crackle. So anyway, I write this movie and with Larry Williams, and we spent a lot of time with Robert Conrad. But the thing is that anytime we would go to a restaurant, I had to go in first, and then we'd have lunch, and then Robert Conrad would say, okay, meet me in the parking lot in 5 minutes. And then he would leave, and then we'd wait 5 minutes, and then I would leave. And this happened over and over again. And finally, I turned to his producer partner, this guy Roger Bacon, who was the son of the great writer for the Herald, James Bacon. What's the deal with me having to leave after him? And he said, you don't know? I said, no, I don't know. He goes, well, he's 5'6" and you're 6'4". He will not walk out of a restaurant next to you. So that was that was the deal. It was so funny that the macho guy with the battery, anyway, he wouldn't. And it was always a thing, like, meet me in the lot in 5. And then he would go, which sounded like one of his characters, like, meet me in the lot at 5. And then he would go, and I have to wait 5 minutes. Okay, I'll go meet him. So that's my Robert Conrad story. There were a few other ones, but some I can't tell. Actually, a good guy. Crazy guy, but a good guy. So let's get to my guest, because this is the second guest I've never met before. I'm trying to branch out. So he is a writer-producer. He's worked on shows like Friends. Some of us have heard of that. Veronica's Closet. Ground Floor. Now, I never heard of that, but he did 19 episodes. So let's talk about that. Two of my favorite shows, Angie Tribeca and Trial and Error. I definitely want to talk about those. Really, really fun. Right up my alley shows. And he did 3 episodes of Hanging with Mr. Cooper that I almost worked on. So I want to talk about that. And he's really famous for being Liz Astroff's brother. Anyway, please welcome Jeff Astroff. Yay! Liz, she and I worked on a show called Raising Hope. And unfortunately, but we just hit it off. It didn't work out for Liz there for whatever reason. But we just hit it off and really, and then we discovered that we both like her much more than me. This place called the Coral Tree.
Sure.
And she's there.
Her haunt.
It's her haunt. She knows, and we always joke about it because she always gets the same thing. She always has the same table and all that. And I always think, like, the people that work there, do they know her? But she's really funny. She doesn't engage with them a lot there, but she's there for 8 hours a day. It's very funny.
Yeah, she's very, she's not allowed in a lot of other restaurants. I'm sure she's told you that. You know, the reason is because she's 6'4".
Yeah,
and people don't like going to restaurants with her. Maybe I misheard your story. Yes, Liz is fantastic. I've known Liz all her life, and she and I are very, very close. She's the funniest person I know.
Yeah, it's really true. And the best laugh, it's just like when you make her laugh, it's so rewarding because it comes back at you and you think like, wow, I'm funny. But she's just got a really infectious laugh.
She does. And it's both. We both have very, like, my authentic laugh is, I think we both learned to laugh from comics because my authentic laugh is ha ha. And it's just, it's very annoying. We both have annoying laughs, but Liz is specifically piercing in the best way.
Yeah.
And she, you can always hear her on the soundtracks of the shows that she's been on.
That's
and,
funny. A guy I know, I'm getting off topic, but a guy I know used to write on Golden Girls. And for some reason, Lucy used to come to tapings to see Golden Girls. And he swears there's a bunch of episodes where you hear that laugh, that, yeah, exactly, at the end of a joke in a Golden Girls taping. So
that's amazing. Really, first of all, I love all the contemporary references we're using already in this show. This is, makes me feel...
Oh, you don't have to worry about the age thing. You don't have to be hip or anything current here. You don't.
No, at home. I love it.
No emojis, no nothing. None of that stuff here.
Yep, I expect us to have many echoes here and struggle with the technology for the next 40 minutes. I love my sister. I don't hang out. I think I joined the Soho House a few years ago. My wife wanted me to kind of branch out from working in my house, I guess. And so I joined the Soho House, which I thought would be fancy. And almost every single day they said, may I help you? And Soho House is like, it's a very fancy place. I'm like, even when I showed my card, the guy was like talking to his lapel. And I was like, no, I belong here. And it's, by the way, the Soho House, like, if anything, I look like a writer. I don't know why they would think I wasn't, but maybe because I brought my own food and fell asleep immediately. So it's not, I'm not good in public places. I think it's impossible. I don't know how you work in a public place.
Well, the Soho House, I've been there, and it's like a really super high-end Starbucks. Because you look around there, and it's all people with computers working, but like a Starbucks. But you've paid a bunch of dough to get in here, and it's kind of fancy. And
yes, I would wake up almost always around the time that like Lionel Richie would be coming and playing piano, and then it was time to go. That's how I knew it was time to go, when I heard "Hello" on the piano. But yes, it was a little bit too fancy for me. And I remember, just the only thing I remember is like pacing outside, talking to my agent about why I wasn't getting certain deals. And maybe that's because I was spending all my time sleeping in Soho House. But very comfortable couches there. I think it's really, it's really nice. If you don't, it's like getting your car serviced at a nice dealership.
Have you ever seen anybody else sleeping there? That's really funny that you'd sort of, would you stretch out on the couch?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, you're supposed to make yourself at home. And the couches are so comfortable. And unlike my house, there's no dogs running in or kids or anything. And it's just, and no one is, I mean, eventually they tell you, sir, you can't do that.
It's like, sleeping on a subway. At some point, they're going to wake you up.
No, but it's extremely comfortable. And I think, you know, if you're going to pay that kind of money, I only went there like, there's like a gym membership. I went there like three times, you know what I mean? And it was like $3,000. So it was a $3,000 naps. And by the way, let me tell you something, worth it.
Really, that's
some of the best sleep I've had.
I'm checking in tonight at the Soho House.
So
let's talk about showbiz. So I'm always legitimately interested, and I know you've probably talked about this before, but how you got started, like how it all happened. Because Liz had you to follow, but I'd love to hear how you did it.
I just wanted somebody to follow me, and I was like, "What could I do?" I was an investment banker.
Really?
Yes.
You did not study any of this in college.
I did stand up comedy in college, and I was always good at writing and comedy. I guess. I mean, not like, you know, whatever. I did some local places in Philadelphia, and you know, I graduated.
So did you go to Penn? Is that why
I had a business school?
Did you go to Penn? Did you go to Penn? Is that why you were in Philadelphia?
I went to Penn. Yes,
gotcha.
It's not quite like dropping Harvard. People are like, oh, okay. I think I have a Penn.
If you're from Doylestown, Pennsylvania, it is. Trust me.
Yes, there we go. So anyway, yes, the Harvard of Philadelphia. And then afterwards I took a job. I lived in Canton, Ohio for a little while. And then I moved to Chicago and Jacksonville. And I came back to New York because I love New York. I'm from New York. And then I would do comedy at Stand Up New York.
But you're still working as an investment banker. You're clocking in the morning and.
I'm clocking in at the morning. I had my punch card. And then the end of the day, I'd slide the dinosaur down and go. And there was definitely, I definitely was funnier than I was a good investment banker. And I won. There was a club called the Boston Comedy Club at the time. And I won Funniest Man on Wall Street, which I always said is like Jewish high jumper. It's like, it's not that big a competition, but I won it. And
do you remember some of your jokes from then?
Oh, they were just all. I kind of don't. I like the thing I was never able to do, which I wish I did, was I never had like a persona that I'd like to just get up there and kind of like riff. That's like the goal, I think. Like me, it was like a lot of self-deprecating jokes and some Jewish jokes and stuff like that. But there's nothing that really like you got to see this guy again.
Right.
And it's funny because I sent my tape in as an audition tape for SNL that year.
Yeah.
Assuming that that's the kind of stuff they were looking for. I assume it came down to me and Chris Rock because they picked Chris Rock. That was his first season. And so, look, they went a different way. It's not the first time, not the last time. Chris Rock has been cast over me in something, but I still think they made the wrong choice. But, I didn't really have a persona. And you know, there's like you have a persona you play and that's. You know, that's the dream is like to get up there and not just, tell dick jokes for,
right.
for five of your friends that they make sure that you, get people to pay for two drinks. But it was fun. I really loved it. So I had a writing partner at the time and he decided he was moving out to California. And I was like, he was working for an advertising company. So he was writing a spec script. And I was like, I didn't know what that was. I grew up on TV, much like Liz did. Watched the Honeymooners on Channel 11 at night and All in the Family and every show just on our stomach while we were doing our TV, doing our homework. My sister and I are not Siamese. We do not have the same stomach, but our collective stomachs, we grew up on TV, but I never thought, wow, someone writes this. And then my partner moved out. My family was less supportive. My dad told me that if I move out to California, he won't tell me when he dies. And I figured, all right, he's not going to tell me when he dies anyway. So I might as well. Thankfully.
So they were not happy you were giving up the job to move out to California.
No, he had just kind of like he was going through some career stuff. And it's like I had a degree from Wharton and I was an investment banker and I was moving out to ostensibly become a waiter, which is what I did. And I delivered sandwiches and I was a food dude. I was a food dude. I delivered sandwiches. I was temp. I was a Talentry temp of the month. And I always tell the story. I had a $100 car, which leaked so much oil. We called it the Valdez. It was the worst investment I ever made. And it had no, it leaked oil. And I was, it cost me, according to the guy who I made rich, it cost me exactly a little bit less than it was worth every single time it needed to be repaired. But it really was like, I feel like it was a conspiracy with everybody on this car. But I remember one time I got called by the Talentry temp agency. There's a little promotion for them. And they were like, they wanted my best temp. So I'm giving them you. And it was like this, we had colossal rains like we had now back then. This was like early 90s. And it was one of those colossal rains. I was like, and I'm like, I can't do data entry because data entry was like $6 an hour. Never mind, I had an Ivy League degree. And it's like, but I was willing to do anything. Like I was, I was struggling. I wanted to be a writer. And I was like, data entry paid like $6 an hour. And I was like, I need to make $12 an hour or else I'm losing money because, between the diesel fuel that and the dry cleaning because it's ruining my clothes to go down there and parking and lunch, I lose $8. And this woman told me, I wish I remembered her name because she told me, I told them I'd give them the best. And if you don't do it, I promise you, you'll never temp in this town again. And she told me that. And that should be, it's one of the many names of one of my many books I've never written.
I was going to say, that's a good title. You'll never temp in this town.
I'll never
really
temp in this
title.
Town again. And it was important to me. It's always been important that I do something good, that I do my job. So I drove down there. I didn't have brakes. So I was like using my handbrake as a rudder and the car is just kind of floating.
I thought I had it rough.
But eventually I got into the Warner Brothers writers program and
this is still with the partner at this point. You get in the Warner's program.
Yeah, I get into the program. I have my writing partner, Mike Sykowitz, and we moved out to LA and immediately, I thought we were going to be like a sitcom duo, like just like living together. I invited my girlfriend out. He didn't expect that to happen. And that was not a good scene. So we kind of went separate ways. And then 14 and a half years later, break up, except for my current relationship. Every relationship I've ever had has gone on decades too long, except for my wife. And that's, that's going strong so far. But and my sister, which is also going strong, different relationship, of course. But so I got to the Warner Brothers writers program, and then we were there, and I was, I was delivering sandwiches at the time. And so I would have to buy my sandwiches. So I would, so I didn't lose my route. And this was just like a totally illegal underground, sandwich, days back when you could deliver sandwiches door to door out of a cooler with no ice.
I remember those guys.
Sure. And, we were passing around staph infection, E. coli, from building to building. Anyway, I met these two guys, Rinsler and Warren, who were running Full House. And, I was like a real wise guy in the class. And they were like, why are you like, you're like, why are you such a wise ass? And I was like, I don't know. It's just who I am. And they said, we're doing a pilot. Do you want to help punch up a pilot? And I didn't know what that was. I was like, yeah, of course I'll do anything. I have to, they pay for my egg salad sandwiches. And I got in the writer's room, and I remember the very first day it was hanging with Mr. Cooper, and they passed around the script, and everyone is like, the guy who wrote it is Jeff Franklin, like huge talent for this type of writing. But it was not that's not like what I grew up watching, like Full House, but obviously he's got several houses and he's done okay for himself.
Yeah, and that's a job.
And I'm on your radio show, so where are we? You know what I mean? So I won, is what I'm saying. The very first day they pass out the scripts, and they're like, everyone's like, he's like, what do you think of this pilot? And everyone's like, you've done it again, Mr. Franklin, surefire hit, home run. And I was like, I don't get it. I was like, excuse me, who's the guy who smells like egg salad? I'm like, yeah, hi, Jeff Astroff. I gotta be honest with you. None of these characters seem different from each other. I don't know where the comedy's coming from. I don't know. I don't know. It seems like it'd be a lot funnier. And he's like, silence.
Yeah, sure.
What would you suggest you do? And I just like, this was just the funnest thing of my life. So I just started pitching jokes. And I remember I got in like 9 jokes. And
this is for the pilot of Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
This is the pilot of Hanging with Mr. Cooper. I am the comedic voice of Hanging with Mr. Cooper. And it was, I got a call that day from the guys who hired me and said, here's the thing. If it's your first job, you never sit in a room and tell the guy who took 6 months to create a pilot that it's not funny and the story doesn't make sense. I was like, did you think it made sense? He goes, it doesn't matter. Of course not.
That's exactly
but this
right.
is not your job. And I said, am I fired? He said, no, you got in too many jokes. And that was kind of like my thing for probably the first, 15 years of my career.
You got in
was just getting in more jokes than I detracted from
that's
the room.
That's great though. That's a great story.
Yeah. So I started there. I was on Hang with Mr. Cooper, and then I went to a show called Duckman, which was actually
animated thing. Jason Alexander.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. It was very funny. That's still like revered in the animation world.
It is. Yes. In a very, very small group of people. And it actually leads to my biggest credit, my biggest false credit.
Well, hold on. We'll use that as a cliffhanger because we got to take a break. Because that's what we do. It's AM. It's AM radio. It's
AM radio. Let's do it. But you'll find out my biggest, not real credit coming
that
up.
That is a tease. I'm talking to Jeff Astroff. You can find him at Jeff Astroff on Twitter and Instagram. His show Shining Veil, which we're going to talk about later, is so good. It's on. It's also on Amazon. You did not mention that. That's where I finally found it. Is on Amazon. It's really good. It's really different. I'll plug May for Watch Sprung on Freevee, and you can find me at TV's Tim Stack. And you're listening to It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack.
Hey, everybody. It's Tim Stack from It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack asking you to watch the show Sprung on Freevee, Amazon's new free channel. I promise you it's funny, it's got heart, and my shoulder appears in episode 3.
Mr. Henderson, this is an email that you sent your trainer/lover, Alfonso. Would you mind reading it, please?
Dear Alfonso, I cannot wait to see you tonight. I'm picking up a bottle of Pinot. What a hilarious joke. Alfonso only likes jammy cabs and Syrahs.
Cute. So on that night, did you come in the...
I beg your pardon?
Did you in the mother... In the mother...
I,
what are you, a sailor? Answer my question. Why won't you answer my mother question?
So, I've decided not to take the stand.
Okay, that is from Trial and Error, created by Jeff Astroff, my guest today. That is so funny, that show. I loved it. I kept telling your sister, you know, I'll use this as a segue to this question. Is there are shows that I wish I had worked on. Two of them are yours, Andy Tribeca, and that you worked on, and Trial and Error. Is there a show you wish you had worked on? Like,
I'd worked on Trial and Error longer than I did. It's very funny you say that, because I look at Trial and Error as a show that, like, I would hate the person who created it, and if it wasn't me, and that's a sign of a show that for a writer, it's like, wow, I really hate that person, they really created that. And it was, I did it with a guy named Matt Miller, but I had the idea for it. You know, there was the Staircase. You ever see The Staircase?
Sure. Sure.
Right. So that was going around writers' rooms like 10 years ago. And I was like, because Liz and I would watch that. And I said, like, this would be the funniest comedy. And I pitched it to Warner Brothers year after year. And to the, you know, and they were all like women TV execs. And they were like, you're doing a show about a guy who kills his wife. So yes, they said, but we want you to do comedy. I was like, it is a comedy. Like, come back with something else. And then finally, like, Making a Murderer came out and Serial came out. So like the time was right for it. But that's the love of my life. That's like, you know, you have a dog, your first dog that you love more than the others. That's a password to everything you own.
Yes.
That's what Trial and Error is to me. That's my show. You know, as to shows that I wish I had written on, you know, everything brings you to a different, everything brings you to a different place. So I'm happy. You know, after Duckman, I really wanted to get onto this show. There were two shows I was up for. One was Friends, and one was a show called Blue Skies, about two guys and a girl who owned a travel agent. And I was sure that one would be a huge hit. And like, that was my first choice. And instead of Friends, I didn't get on that show, didn't go, but then I didn't get on a show called Double Rush with Diane English. And like,
that was also, you know, so ahead of Friends.
So I got on Friends. So I had to slum it on Friends. And now I'm working with Courtney again, 30 years later. Yes. But, you know, so I have come to take the opinion that anything that you work on kind of gets you where you are, if you're happy where you're at. I'm very excited to be, you know, to have a show. I think having any show, I think any show you do, you have to be proud of to get out of bed. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think anything, I mean, there's also the money fact, you know, there's also like, they pay you a bunch.
Oh, the money part. That's what I meant. Yeah. That's what I meant. The money. Yes. It's about the money.
But let's go back to Trial and Error for a second. I do have one question about that. So,
ask me. I could talk about Trial and Error for hours, and I have, and I will, and I actually have them on a text chain now, the whole cast. And if I text anything to them, it just erupts, and I'm getting things back from, you know, from the entire cast immediately, like we never left. It's really sad for
the
all
one
of
who
us.
Really impressed me in that was that Gemma Mays. I thought she was amazing in that
amazing.
Show.
Amazing. I loved her. I mean, yeah, she was, and she unfortunately, for some reason, I have a thing of writing women of a certain age. I'm probably, you know, I'm guessing chemically I'm a woman of a certain age. If you took my blood, it would come out woman of a certain age. Ashkenazi woman of a certain age. And, you know, I I felt like she was completely and still is completely underused as a talent. Like
I couldn't agree. I totally agree. She
yeah, she always plays the hapless wife who has her arms crossed, and that's not who she is. She's so talented in so many layers, and you know, it was just there was not a single thing I gave her that she couldn't do. Interestingly, right. You know, she came in to read for the part of Rosemary that ultimately went to Mira Sorvino, and she didn't. That wasn't right for her, but right. I really do think that she could do. I would love to write for her again. I loved her. I love the whole cast. The whole cast operated just well above and beyond, I think, what they've been given, especially John Lithgow. I don't know what happened to him, but
that was my next question. It's like, how do you work up giving John Lithgow a note? Like, what do you do? How does that process work?
So I, you know, Trial and Error was the first time I got a show on the air, and I know that's not, it's, you know, it had been after like 25 years in the business. So
good,
like,
you
know, I'd worked a long time, you know, half as long as he had. And, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect when working with John. And John, I will say this, John is the nicest guy I've ever worked with. And I've worked with
my niece
really nice
is
guys.
His assistant right now. And says my niece, Emma, is his assistant right now.
Nicest guy in the world.
Right? Nicest guy in the world. Yeah. Just loves him.
Yeah, we called him like immediately when we met him, like you hugged him. And by the way, I can't believe, I think the thing that you dropped in the beginning, which is all we should be talking about, is that you're 6'4". That's incredible. Like, you do not play 6'4" on Zoom.
No, I don't. On Zoom, I don't.
No, you play 5'9", like me.
Yeah.
But that's a sign of your humility.
It's fun when I meet people taller than me, like Bill O'Reilly, for example. Nobody knows that. That guy's taller than me.
Right. He has, what is he, like 6'6"?
He's like 6'6". And when I was on, I'm getting off topic now, when I was on his show promoting, this is way back, promoting Nightstand, he wanted to like get into it with me about these TV talk shows and these daytime, and it was like, that's not what Nightstand is. It's like, you know, we're making fun of those shows. And he really wanted to get an argument. I kept trying to change the topic. And finally, I looked into the camera. I said, you know, he's 6'6". You'd never know this talking to him. Like, don't change the topic. Let's get back.
This is Tim Stack show. So John also very tall, 6'5". You know, he's in the Tim Stack, you know, he'd match up against you in the basketball. And the very first day, I'm in the room and it's really tough writing a show. I always say, like, people say, is your job hard? I say, yes, I'm 28 years old. Look at me. And that joke always gets too much of a laugh when, cause I look old.
I'll do your laugh.
And you're like,
ha ha.
Yeah, that's a good Liz laugh. You know, he called me down there like, Mr. Lithgow would like to talk to you. I'm like, oh, what does he want? And he's like, I'm going to get a haircut. Is there anything you want me to do? I was like, what do you mean? He goes, like, anything okay with my hair? It's like, I don't know, whatever you want to do. Like, that was, it's like, okay. And like you say, like pitching, I never gave him a note. I assume that it's like, I worked with Julie Louis-Dreyfus for 5 years.
Yeah.
If a joke didn't work, it was not her fault. And the same thing with John. And John would like, if something didn't work, I was like, John, let me give you something else here. He's like, no, I will make it work. He was so adamant that the written word was like, you know, it was printed on stone. It was taken down the mountain on two stone tablets, and he would not change a thing. And just really, really great guy. I never did give him a note. The only thing in the beginning, he asked me, he said, what have I done that in my career that you look at that makes you think I could do this? Like every single thing you've ever done.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I asked him, you know, he plays a potential murderer. I asked him if he wanted to, you know, he had never seen The Staircase before, and I told him not to watch it because I didn't want him doing an impression.
Right.
And he asked me, I said, do you want to know if you had done it or not? And he said, yes, but I'll never betray that. And, you know, he was having a hard time grasping the character, and the character has, you know, the character is a very oddball character.
Right.
And, you know, has to walk this line. And he finally got it by watching Jacques Tati, and he wound up cuffing his pants a half an inch higher than normal. And that helped him get the character.
So funny. Actors are so crazy and funny.
I know. So I was like, yeah, do that. That's exactly what I had in mind. We knew it the whole time is wardrobe.
But a lot of actors will do that, or they'll find a prop, or that's their process, is they have to, they need something to give them that little edge that they can focus on. And
Can I tell you another actor story? Well, it's a departure, and then we'll get back to you because I have questions too. So I had the great honor of working with Bob Gunton on the show, who is of Shawshank and the warden in Shawshank, and also such a great guy. And we did an episode where he's golfing, and two of my writers were down there, watching him golf, and he's hitting the ball pretty well. And, they were making small talk. They go, do you golf a lot? And he said, no, I've never golfed in my life. And they said, well, but you're hitting the ball really well. He said, my character golfs. And I just thought, wow, this is like amazing. This is a guy who would take a helicopter up. My character flies a helicopter. Like, my character does surgery. I thought, like, incredible. Like, if they have that, like, that's the difference between writers and actors right there, is that degree of confidence.
Yeah.
Like, or the greats. Like, it's very, very old school. Is like, he started smoking because his character smoked. He probably still smokes now because of it. But he was totally in character, and, it was great. I love working with legends, which is why I'm here, Tim.
Wow. On that note, let's take our second break. Jeff Astroff is here. You can find him at Jeff Astroff. More importantly, watch his show, Shining Veil. We're going to talk about that in the next segment, because I'm just really impressed by it on a whole bunch of reasons, which we'll talk about. And you're listening to me, Tim Stack, on It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack, and we'll be right back.
Guys, this move is really going to be great for us.
Probably not. I'm on my way back home. Are you shitting us?
No, we're not shitting you. Let's go check it out.
Welcome to Shining Vale.
Really cold in here. Does the heat work?
I mean, the house has been empty for nearly 2 years. She's probably not used to having people inside of her. Kat is a writer.
I haven't written anything meaningful in 7 years. I've been in a really dark place lately. My kids ignore me. Terry's at work. I'm hoping that being out in the country is going to help me find my muse again.
If we don't get the first chapter next month, I want the advance back.
No pressure.
Patricia, what are you doing in my house?
Kat's seeing ghosts.
Ghosts? One ghost.
Good news. You're not crazy.
There are dark forces in that house. Wear this medal.
I'm not really a saint person.
Put it on!
Okay.
Wonderful. Use your words, Patricia.
And keep it filthy. That's your brand.
All of a sudden, I wrote 13 pages. I don't remember writing. I'm good. I found my muse.
That was a long clip, but worth it. That's from my guest show. It's called Shining Veil. It was made for Stars, but I saw it on Amazon, which I'm so happy about that I was able to find. Your sister kept telling me, it's on Hulu. It's like, no, it's not on Hulu.
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know where it's on. I think that's why. I have no idea where it's on, but I know it comes from Stars.
It comes from Stars. It's on Amazon, and you can watch you can watch both seasons.
The first season is out. The second season is dropping, I think, in the fall. We just finished it, and I'm starting to write the third season now.
Oh, that's great. That's really great. Okay, let's talk about that. To answer your question real quick about Nightstand with Dick Dietrich, that show, because I'm older than you, there was a show on called Fernwood Tonight. This is in the 70s. Norman Lear, Martin Mull was the host. Fred Willard was the sidekick. And Nightstand sort of was to daytime talk what Fernwood Tonight was to the old Mike Douglas show. That's sort of how it was pitched. And then, you know, so, you know.
How many years did the Nightstand go?
It was two seasons, but we did 96 episodes.
Holy cow.
Oh, it was crazy. We shot them on weekends and because it was just one set. Very rarely would we go off the set. So we were able to do it. It was crazy. It was.
And was it all written or was there a lot of improv?
It was all written. No, it was all written. It was just, there was no time to improvise. And because we had to get both shows done. We did five shows a weekend, 2.5 shows. Some actor would get paid twice because they had to work Friday and Saturday. It was a crazy schedule, but we got it done. It was really fun.
My sister and I will every now and again, like we'll say a double entendre go, yeah. People, no, no, people, no,
no people. Oh, that's awful.
I love it. It is really, I think I put in the coming up, famous diarrhea stories or whatever it was with the gymnast. Yes. Was just, it's. The perfect, it's my perfect level of humor. It's like right here.
Yeah, I think it was like, you're on a balance beam.
Yes.
You're having diarrhea. Then what happened?
No, it was like you had a double cappuccino.
Yeah. Okay. That's it. You know the joke better than that.
It was like the setup was like, you're wearing a white leotard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Double cappuccino. Then what happened?
Then what happened?
Coming up after the diarrhea. It was genius. I don't use the word that frequently, but I will use it for that.
Well, thank you. Well, somebody else, that show was somebody else's idea that we developed together. So let's talk about your idea, Shining Veil, which again, it's really, really great. And here's my big kudos to you, is a lot of people think they can combine genres. Like, you know, like, yeah, we're just going to do this. And it's not easy to do that.
No, it was... So the idea, it was actually when I was doing Trial and Error, when I was doing what turned out to be the series finale of Trial and Error, I thought it was a season finale. My home studio, Warner Brothers, said, what else do you have? What are you going to do next? I was like, honestly, probably get like a bowel resection. I've been having so much coffee. Like, what do you mean, what am I do next? Like, I don't know, like go into rehab? What do you mean? Like, no, we know what's your next show, because Trial and Error was wrapping up. And I was literally just, I was in Vancouver writing the finale. And they're like, we want to know what your next project is. And I understand that I work for them and have a deal with them. And so I was like, I don't have any original ideas left. I don't like, because you're all, you know, when you're doing a show, it's very hard to do multiple shows. And at least for me, there are some people who are effortless at it. And it's for me, I throw everything I have into it.
Yeah, most people are like you. I don't think I would be able to. Focus.
Yeah, it's very different. And there are people who do. My partner, for example, is someone who's not, and that's Sharon Horgan. And so I met with this producer named Aaron Kaplan, and he pitched me these different things. And he said, I have something. Sharon Horgan wants to do The Shining, but as a comedy. I was like, I'm in. So I talked to her, and she said, you know, do you think it's possible to do a horror that's as scary as it is funny? She said, because a lot of times when they try to do comedy horrors, they're either scary or they're funny. Do you think you have something? Do you think we could do it? And I thought for a second, I'm not a big horror buff. And I thought, I was like, yes, because I know that like after you see a horror movie, you laugh after you scream. So I was like, okay, so it's all part of the same continuum of just surprising people. And for me, I've been doing this and you've been doing this a while too. It's like, it's hard to find, I call like fresh snow. Like I did sitcoms for 25 years before I did my first single camera show. Yeah. Actually, no, Angie Tribeca helped me. And I did that to help a friend. We were talking about before. That was the first time. And they had to tell me to stop laughing because I didn't realize I'm used to an audience. And like, I'm like, why do they keep doing this again? And it's like, because that was just one shot. Like, what do you mean? Like, it took me a while to realize I'd never done a single camera show before, really my own. And now I'm like, oh, I love single camera shows. I love the.
They're much easier.
You know, I'm in post production on season two while I'm writing season three. So it's like, you know, I wanted to kind of challenge myself in my different parts of my brain. So, you know, Sharon Horgan had the kernel of the idea, and she had this kind of quote that she found that I really latched onto about how women are more than twice as likely as men to be depressed and more than twice as likely as men to be possessed, and the symptoms are the same. And then so like we ran with it, and I the very first scene I wrote, I hung up the phone with her, and I wrote the scene in the pilot. If you've seen the pilot, this the penultimate scene with the deer in the backyard, I wrote that scene without knowing any of the characters or anything really? Else. And I sent that to her. I said, this is how you would do it. And she's like, yeah, you could do it. And then so, and then it was very, very hard for me because my instinct was, I had to break so many instincts, and she really helped me break instincts in a way only as honest and cruel as someone like she could be. And she's, and you know, she's a writer also, so it's easy for her to, you know, she gives smart notes, and she'd say stuff like, are you really going to do a callback here? And I was like, my house is built on callbacks. You don't understand.
Love callbacks.
The first floor is the joke. The second floor is the callback. Like, that's my entire career is a callback.
I called back your laugh on this show.
Yeah, by the way. So, you know, and then, but she really helped me. But the whole thing was the tone and getting, you know, was finding that right tone and that right balance. And it's still very, very difficult. Every first cut I look at is just like, I'm like, well, I'm done. Career's over. Everything, they're taking away my friend's credit. Like, it's just like you assume that everything is over because it is, you know, it's horror plays in like different shot, like comedy usually plays in the close up, horror plays like more in the wide. And so, and also what I've learned, because they gave me two writers. I had one comedy writer and one horror writer. And and never the twain shall meet. They're such different animals, like horror writers and comedy writers. They just know when one side is talking, the other side just glazes over, and right. Vice versa. It's very, very cool and weird.
And not probably not the easiest thing. But I think this is just me talking, but I feel like you're almost selling yourself short on, you're saying, horror and comedy. There's also, you know, it's a family show. That's the other thing. And it's a show about a woman struggling with mental illness. And,
yes.
And I don't know, somehow you've been able to do it all in a really well shot. I love the music too. I thought that you did just really great choices in that because, yeah, there's the element of horror. I'm just talking about the music for a second. There's the element of horror, but there's also the element of comedy in just in the music.
And, yes. So that's Tim Phillips did our score. It's very, very cool. I'm very, very proud of it. The thing I latched onto about and the thing I thought was going to be difficult, first of all, there's an ego thing when somebody else, like you mentioned, somebody else came up with Nightstand. Like, it's like, I still have to, you know, Sharon Horgan is the big name in the room. And it was her original idea. I ran the show. Thankfully, COVID kept her far away. So I got to run it. I was very, very lucky to run the show. And she's very, very generous with me in that. I really latched on the things that I was worried about because her show, she has a different sense of humor than I do, by the way, obviously brilliant and can do 10 things, but her show Catastrophe, which I love, is much darker. I mean, it's real reality based. So I wanted to say like, okay, keep the character stuff, but I wanted to do a show with a heart to it. And then once we cast Courtney, that was very, very easy because people love Courtney. It's like, oh, Monica.
She's so nice in real life too. She's just a nice person.
The absolute, absolute best. I mean, she's like, again, I've been so, so blessed to work with really nice people. And she is the sweetest of the sweet. They all are. The whole cast is. And it's also nice being around their age too and having that experience because they trust me. And also the other thing with, which is a good idea, if you can cast something, if you could write something no one else has done, you're the only person who knows how to do it. So
it's a burden,
but they trust you.
Yeah.
But, I love the mental illness part. I'm very lucky to come from a long line of mental illness.
who is it? You're in show business. Who is it? Oh, believe me. We've talked. She's so funny about that stuff. And it was my favorite things on her show, Pivoting, was the drug episode where she was drugging up the teacher to get her child something. I said, that is so perfect. And I live in Santa Barbara. Trust me, I saw it when my kids went through school. So, and the other thing, and we're not talking enough about Greg Kinnear, who's really good. I mean, he's just really solid in that, especially in the pilot, you see this guy who's working, he's working a little hard at trying to keep this thing together, and yet there's clearly another side to him that, again, it's really, really good casting. They can all do funny stuff, but at the same time, they're selling the real stuff, too, and that's necessarily easy.
Yeah, casting is writing is 100% casting, you know, and we all the same writers where we said like the same writers who wrote Friends wrote Veronica's Closet, you know what I mean? Like it's like and Veronica's Closet had a good cast, too. It just wasn't the same like lightning in the bottle. But yes, Greg, it was very interesting because when we cast, you know, the character of Pat, played by Courtney, is not immediately a likable person on paper. She is, you know, she cheated on her husband. She's alcoholic. She's admittedly not a good mom. You know, she curses. I think we have more curses than in The Wire, but that's also because cursing is a symptom. Everything is by design. It wasn't people like, oh, it's gratuitous. It's not gratuitous. I mean, maybe it is, but they're all symptoms of mental illness and possession is that you curse a lot. If you do look, I did a lot of research and there's such an overlap, probably because they used to think that possession was mental illness. And then the people who believe in possession think that mental illness, that demons attack people who are mentally ill.
So that's interesting.
They have a good cover.
Wow.
But we cast Courtney and I was like, okay, so everyone's going to love this character. This is going to be easy. But then we cast Greg and Greg was more likable because Greg is so, he fills up a screen and he breaks your heart. So then like I had to pull Courtney back and even in editing it, you couldn't go from tight shot to tight shot because you're like, I love Courtney, but I love Greg more. So now I don't like Courtney. As much.
Yeah, but so, it balances out as you watch the show. And anyway, just a really, really good job. We got to take our third and final break until our big conclusion that we build to.
This is amazing. People are hanging. I don't even know what's going
to
happen.
People pull over the side of the road because they're on AM radio, so they pull over to listen. They don't want to touch the dial. You're listening to It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack. I've got Jeff Astroff on. Find him on Twitter and Instagram at Jeff Astroff. Mostly, though, watch his show Shining Veil, which we just talked about. It's on Stars and Amazon, and we'll be right back.
It's Tim Stack, and having been in show business for so long, I have a lot of really funny friends, and you can hear them all on It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack. That's part of the Jeremiah Show. So listen.
I don't have to do it.
Okay, Phoebe?
Yeah, no, I'm just, it's not even worth it. It's my bank. What did they do to you? It's not, it's just, okay. I'm going through my mail, and I open up their monthly, you know, statement.
Easy.
And there's $500 extra dollars in my account.
Oh, Satan's minions at work again?
Yes, because now I have to go down there and deal with them.
What are you talking about? Keep it.
It's not mine. I didn't earn it. If I kept it, it would be like stealing.
Yeah, but if you spent it, it would be like shopping.
Okay, let's say I bought a really great pair of shoes. Do you know what I hear with every step I took? Not mine, not mine, not mine. And even if I was happy, okay, and skipping, I'd hear, not mine, not mine. We're with you.
That was an episode of Friends called The One with the Thumbs that you wrote.
Yes. That was the very first episode. That was the very first episode of Friends after the pilot that was written. My partner, Mike Sykwitz, and I wrote it.
Oh, so you were in there on day one after the pilot. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was the very first episode that was written after the pilot. That wasn't the one that aired after the pilot, but that was the first one that we shot.
Right. And you were not at the table read, the famous Friends table read.
The initial one?
Yes.
No, I got hired after it. I got hired after it was picked up. Like it was I was staff writer, story editor on the show.
Is there? I'm going to say this. This is going to sound weird, but there's certain things in life. Like everybody just loves this, and I'm being honest. Like Friends to me, you wrote on the show. I don't mean this is not a dispersion on you. Like I get why it's so successful. Like I completely get it. It just wasn't like a tune in for me. And I'm wondering, is there something like that in your life? Like everybody loves blank and you're kind of like, yeah, I get it, but I'm not crazy about it.
Yeah. It's funny because it's, yes, I know you mentioned this. Not everybody is crazy about Friends. I don't know that Friends would have been my show to watch. And I don't know. It's very hard for me to separate just because if I'm jealous of something, like I don't love Ted Lasso, like I tried to get through it.
I'm completely with you, but I understand why people.
Yeah, no, I understand. I like, he's a likable guy, and I understand that, you know, I understand like a feel good thing, but it's not like, it's not my thing. Like there are certain movies that people love, and I'm trying to think that I was just like, okay. We talked about this in the room today because I'm in a room that's half horror and half not. Again, our tastes in movies are very, very different, but, you know, like it's, I'm trying to think of like shows that like my favorite shows in history have been like some of the great shows, but I don't know, like honestly, like this is going to sound like sacrilege. Now I'm going to say this and you're going to think it's sacrilege. Like I liked Seinfeld. But it wasn't like if I missed Seinfeld, like growing up, like I couldn't miss All in the Family or MASH.
Yes. Saturday nights on CBS.
Yes. Or yes, I couldn't miss any of those shows. Like Seinfeld, I gave up on after a couple of seasons. That's like, so that's sacrilege. I've never said that.
I know people. And it's like the Rolling Stones. I'm like, yeah, they're all right. I don't like.
Yeah. I mean, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. And they exist. It's always interesting. So, but Friends was obviously really good for your career to be on a hit show like that.
Oh, it really, famously, we left Friends also after the second season. So we became also a cautionary tale. And there's not that many people who can brag of being a cautionary tale of, you know, with the peak bests of TV. But like I said, it wound up, you know, I met my wife afterwards, and they say, you know, you always say this, you can't put a price on your wife. For me, she cost me about $28 million, but it's worth it every day, my wife and kids.
Similar thing with me in Saturday Night Live. Like, I don't know that I would still be with my wife and I were at a strange point when I was almost on the show. They didn't offer me a job, so it's not like the same thing of you not going back to Friends. They were saying, no, get out of here. But had it worked out, I'm not sure. I
talked to a very good friend of mine who is like this, I mean, different industry, but he said the same thing. He left, you know, had a chance to make a lot of money and he was convinced. I always wonder that, like I'm very, very grateful for what I've accomplished. And I have a show on the air and that's, you know, I love that. I love what I do. I love coming to work and, you know, for the most part, especially now just developing stories is, you know, it's great because, you know, no one's telling you that you're wrong yet.
Well, as you said earlier, you've also developed your own sort of unique niche show that what are they going to give notes on? Because it's like
they don't give a lot. They give a lot of the notes that I get. And Starz has been great. And Warner Brothers is just purely it's also because I've gotten to this like kind of like age where I'm like, I'm, you know, I know what I'm doing enough and I'm old enough. I don't have enough money to not take notes. Like I don't have enough, so I still take notes. But I'm also collaborative and, you know, if someone has a good idea, but you know, I don't know. I love what I do, but I always wondered, like, I never got like the big, you know, like the big show, you know, the big hit show.
I don't think those exist anymore. So what you have
those don't exist, but you know, like I honestly thought like Trial and Error was like, I thought I hit that out of the park. Like, you know, you have a show with John Lithgow. I thought like I hit that out of the park and I had to fight so hard. And it's another hour conversation to get that show picked up for a second season. We had to cut cost. We had a cut. We had to cut the budget in a third. I moved to Canada. We stole a stage from Arrow, and then took other stages. But we took the court set. Like, we were up in Vancouver. Like, whoa, you throwing that out? We'll take it. That was the courtroom.
It's on, like, the curve. It's like you see a couch on the curve.
Yeah, they were putting the whoa, back up. Get a truck. Put that. Don't throw that out. And that was that show just died after two seasons, and it's just it breaks my heart, and
we got to wrap it up, but you've got this great show. I just can't recommend it enough. It's real. I can't wait to dive back in. I got my wife hooked too.
Great. Thank you.
It's really, really good. It's really different. Again, it's just really well shot. The directing is great. It's just really Shining Vale. You can find it on Amazon now, so that's easier to find than Stars.
Yes.
Most people seem to have Amazon more than Stars. Anyway, Jeff, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure being with the great Tim Stack. I am such a big fan of your work, and mostly that my sister says such nice things about you, all of which seem to be true so far.
So far. Well, no, it's good. Jeff, thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. And you've been listening to It's Radio with TV's Tim Stack.
As always, a big thanks to our station manager, Les Carroll, for letting us on the air at all. Listeners, we appreciate you and want to hear from you. Please send us your ideas at jeremiah@thejeremiahshow.com or on Messenger, on Facebook, or Instagram. The show is produced by executive producer Jeremiah Higgins and me, your announcer, Tony Kelly.